Amazing book.
Right. You know, it's just too much to put in the actual book, man. So, you know, I can go on and kind of freestyle some of this stuff.
Amazing stuff. And so for years, you were obsessed with Scott's story and kind of changed your life after meeting him.
Yeah, it changed my life, but you know, I kind of went back to my old ways.
Yeah.
And, but as you all hear here pretty soon, I went back to my old ways. But, yeah, he was just, just that person that was like, it is possible. There was a real live Rambo out there. So it gave me some hope.
For years, I was obsessed with that story because he'd survived the impossible and I resonated with his survival. After Wilmoth's murder, with all those racist taunts raining down on my head, I won't bore you with every single episode. Just know there were many more. I felt like I was free-falling with no fucking chute. Guerin was living proof that it's possible to transcend anything that doesn't kill you. And from the time I heard him speak, I knew I would enlist in the Air Force after graduation, which only made school seem more irrelevant. Especially after I was cut from the varsity basketball team during my junior year. I wasn't cut because of my skills. The coaches knew I was one of the best players they had, and that I loved the game. Johnny and I played it night and day. Our entire friendship was based on basketball. But because I was angry at the coaches for how they used me on the JV team the year before, I didn't attend summer workouts. And they took that as a lack of commitment to the team. They didn't know or care that when they cut me, they'd eliminated any incentive I'd had to keep my GPA up, which I'd barely managed to do through cheating anyway. Now I had no good reason to attend school. At least that's what I thought, because I was clueless about the emphasis that the military places on education. I figured they'd take anybody. Two incidents convinced me otherwise and inspired me to change. The first was when I failed the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery Test, ASVAB, during my junior year. The ASVAB is the Armed Forces version of the SATs. It's a standardized test that allows the military to assess your current knowledge and future potential for learning at the same time, and I showed up for that test prepared to do what I did best, cheat. I'd been copying on every test in every class for years, but when I took my seat for the ASVAB, I was shocked to see that the people seated to my right and left had different tests than I did. I had to go it alone and scored a 20 out of a possible 99 points. The absolute minimum standard to be admitted to the Air Force is only 36, and I couldn't even get there. The second sign that I needed to change arrived with a postmark just before school let out for the summer after junior year. My mother was still in her emotional black hole after Wilmoth's murder, and her coping mechanism was to take on as much as possible. She worked full-time at DePaul University and taught night classes at Indiana State University, because if she stopped hustling long enough to think, she would realize the reality of her life. She kept it moving, was never around, and never asked to see my grades. After the first semester of our junior year, I remember Johnny and me bringing home F's and D's. We spent 2 hours doctoring the ink. We turned F's into B's and D's into C's, and we're laughing the whole damn time. I actually remember feeling a perverse pride in being able to show my fake grades to my mother, but she never even asked to see them. She took my damn word for it. We lived parallel lives in the same house, and since I was more or less raising myself, I stopped listening to her. In fact, about 10 days before the letter arrived, she'd kicked me out because I refused to come home from a party before curfew. She told me that if I didn't, I shouldn't come home at all. In my mind, I had already been living by myself for several years. I made my own meals, cleaned my own clothes. I wasn't angry at her. I was cocky and figured I didn't need her anymore. I stayed out that night, and for the next week and a half, I crashed at Johnny's place or with other friends. Eventually, the day came when I'd spent my last dollar. By chance, she called me at Johnny's that morning and told me about a letter from school. It said I'd missed over a quarter of the year due to unexcused absences, that I had a D average, and unless I showed significant improvement in my GPA and attendance during my senior year, I would not graduate. She wasn't emotional about it. She was more exhausted than exasperated. "I'll come home and get the note," I said. "No need for that," she replied. "I just wanted you to know that you were flunking out." I showed up on her doorstep later that day with my stomach growling. I didn't ask for forgiveness, and she didn't demand an apology. She just left the door open and walked away. I stepped into the kitchen and made myself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. She passed me the letter without saying a word. I read it in my room, where the walls were papered over with layers of Michael Jordan and Special Ops posters, inspiration for twin passions slipping through my fingers. That night, after taking a shower, I wiped the steam away from our corroded bathroom mirror and took a good look. I didn't like who I saw staring back. I was a low-budget thug with no purpose and no future. I felt so disgusted, I wanted to punch that motherfucker in the face and shatter glass. Instead, I lectured him. It was time to get real. "Look at you," I said. "Why do you think the Air Force wants your punk ass? You stand for nothing? You are an embarrassment." I reached for the shaving cream, smoothed the thin coat over my face, unwrapped a fresh razor, and kept talking as I shaved. "You are one dumb motherfucker. You read like a third grader. You're a fucking joke. You've never tried hard at anything in your life besides basketball, and you have goals? That's fucking hilarious." After shaving peach fuzz from my cheeks and chin, I lathered up my scalp. I was desperate for a change. I wanted to become someone new. "You don't see people in the military sagging their pants. You need to stop talking like a wannabe gangster. None of this shit is gonna cut it. No more taking the easy way out. It's time to grow the fuck up." Steam billowed all around me. It rippled off my skin and poured from my soul. What started as a spontaneous venting session had become a solo intervention. "It's on you," I said. "Yeah, I know shit is fucked up. I know what you've been through. I was there, bitch. Merry fucking Christmas. Nobody is coming to save your ass. Not your mommy, not Wilmoth, nobody. It's up to you." By the time I was done talking, I was shaved clean. Water pearled on my scalp, streamed from my forehead, and dripped down the bridge of my nose. I looked different, and for the first time, I'd held myself accountable. A new ritual was born, one that stayed with me for years. It would help me get my grades up, whip my sorry ass into shape, and see me through graduation and into the Air Force. The ritual was simple. I'd shave my face and scalp every night, get loud, and get real. I set goals, wrote them on post-it notes, and tagged them to what I now call the accountability mirror, because each day I'd hold myself accountable to the goals I'd set. At first, my goals involved shaping up my appearance and accomplishing all my chores without having to be asked. "Make your bed like you're in the military every day. Pull up your pants. Shave your head every morning. Cut the grass. Wash all dishes." The accountability mirror kept me on point from then on, and though I was still young when this strategy came through me, since then I found it useful for people at any stage in life. You could be on the cusp of retirement, looking to reinvent yourself. Maybe you're going through a bad breakup or have gained weight. Perhaps you're permanently disabled, overcoming some other injury, or are just coming to grips with how much of your life you've wasted, living without purpose. In each case, that negativity you're feeling is your internal desire for change, but change doesn't come easy. And the reason this ritual worked so well for me was because of my tone. I wasn't fluffy. I was raw, because that was the only way to get myself right. That summer, between my junior and senior year in high school, I was afraid. I was insecure. I wasn't a smart kid. I'd blown off all accountability for my entire teenage existence, and actually thought I was getting over on all the adults in my life, getting over on the system. I duped myself into a negative feedback loop of cheating and scamming that on the surface looked like advancement until I hit a brick fucking wall called reality. That night when I came home and read the letter from my school, there was no denying the truth, and I delivered it hard. I didn't dance around and say, "Geez, David, you're not taking your education very seriously." No, I had to own it in the raw, because the only way we can change is to be real with ourselves. If you don't know shit and have never taken school seriously, then say, "I'm dumb." Tell yourself that you need to get your ass to work because you're falling behind in life. If you look in the mirror and you see a fat person, don't tell yourself that you need to lose a couple of pounds. Tell the truth. You're fucking fat. It's okay. Just say you're fat if you're fat. The dirty mirror that you see every day is going to tell you the truth every time. So why are you still lying to yourself? So you can feel better for a few minutes and stay the fucking same? If you're fat, you need to change the fact that you're fat because it's very fucking unhealthy. I know, because I've been there. If you have worked for 30 years doing the same shit you've hated day in and day out because you are afraid to quit and take a risk, you've been living like a pussy. Period. Point blank. Tell yourself the truth, that you've wasted enough time and that you have other dreams that will take courage to realize so you don't die a fucking pussy. Call yourself out. Nobody likes to hear the hard truth. Individually and as a culture, we avoid what we need to hear most. This world is fucked up. There are major problems in our society. We are still dividing ourselves up along racial and cultural lines, and people don't have the balls to hear it. The truth is, racism and bigotry still fucking exist, and some people are so thin-skinned they refuse to admit that. To this day, many in Brazil claim that there is no racism in their small town. That's why I have to give Kirk Freeman props. When I called him in the spring of 2018, he remembered what I went through very clearly. He's one of the few who isn't afraid of the truth. But if you are the only, and you aren't stuck in some real-world genocidal twilight zone, you'd better get real, too. Your life is not fucked up because of overt racist or hidden systemic racism. You aren't missing out on opportunities, making shit money, and getting evicted because of America or Donald fucking Trump, or because your ancestors were slaves, or because some people hate immigrants or Jews or harass women or believe gay people are going to hell. If any of that shit is stopping you from excelling in life, I've got some news. You are stopping you. You are giving up instead of getting hard. Tell the truth about the real reasons for your limitations, and you will turn that negativity, which is real, into jet fuel. Those odds stacked against you will become a damn runway. There is no more time to waste. Hours and days evaporate like creeks in the desert. That's why it's okay to be cruel to yourself, as long as you realize you're doing it to become better. We all need thicker skin to improve in life. Being soft when you look in the mirror isn't going to inspire the wholesale changes we need to shift our present and open up our future. The morning after that first session with the accountability mirror, I trashed the shag steering wheel and the fuzzy dice. I tucked my shirt in and wore my pants with a belt, and once school started up again, I stopped eating at my lunch table. For the first time, being liked and acting cool were a waste of my time, and instead of eating with all the popular kids, I found my own table and ate alone. Mind you, the rest of my progress could not be described as a blink-and-you'll-miss-it metamorphosis. Lady Luck did not suddenly show up, run me a hot, soapy bath, and kiss me like she loved me. In fact, the only reason I didn't become just another statistic is because at the last possible moment, I got to work. During my senior year in high school, all I cared about was working out, playing basketball, and studying, and it was the accountability mirror that kept me motivated to keep pushing towards something better. I woke up before dawn and started going to the YMCA most mornings at 5 a.m., before school, to hit the weights. I ran all the damn time, usually around the local golf course after dark. One night I ran 13 miles, the most I'd ever run in my entire life. On that run, I came to a familiar intersection. It was the same street where that redneck had pulled a gun on me. I avoided it and ran on, covering a half mile in the opposite direction before something told me to turn back. When I arrived at that intersection a second time, I stopped and contemplated it. I was scared shitless of that street. My heart was leaping from my chest, which is exactly why I suddenly started charging down its fucking throat. Within seconds, two snarling dogs got loose and chased me as the woods leaned in on both sides. It was all I could do to stay a step ahead of the beasts. I kept expecting that truck to reappear and run me the fuck down like some scene from Mississippi circa 1965, but I kept running, faster and faster until I was breathless. Eventually the hounds of hell gave up and loped off, and it was just me, the rhythm and steam of my breath, and that deep country quiet. It was cleansing. By the time I turned back, my fear was gone. I owned that fucking street. From then on, I brainwashed myself into craving discomfort. If it was raining, I would go run. Whenever it started snowing, my mind would say, "Get your fucking running shoes on." Sometimes I wussed out and had to deal with it at the accountability mirror. But facing that mirror, facing myself, motivated me to fight through uncomfortable experiences. And as a result, I became tougher. And being tough and resilient helped me meet my goals. Nothing was as hard for me as learning. The kitchen table became my all-day, all-night study hall. After I'd failed the ASVAB a second time, my mother realized that I was serious about the Air Force. So she found me a tutor who helped me figure out a system I could use to learn. That system was memorization. I couldn't learn just by scratching a few notes and memorizing those. I had to read a textbook and write each page down in my notebook, then do it again a second and third time. That's how knowledge stuck to the mirror of my mind, not through learning, but through transcription, memorization, and recall. I did that for English. I did that for history. I wrote out and memorized formulas for algebra. If my tutor took an hour to teach me a lesson, I had to go back over my notes from that session for 6 hours to lock it in. My personal study hall schedule and goals became post-it notes on my accountability mirror. And guess what happened? I developed an obsession for learning. Over 6 months, I went from having a fourth grade reading level to that of a senior in high school. My vocabulary mushroomed. I wrote out thousands of flashcards and went over them for hours, days, and weeks. I did the same for mathematical formulas. Part of it was survival instinct. I damn sure wasn't going to get into college based on academics. And though I was a starter on the varsity basketball team my senior year, no college scouts knew my name. All I knew was that I had to get the fuck out of Brazil, Indiana, that the military was my best chance, and to get there I had to pass the ASVAB. On my third try, I met the minimum standard for the Air Force. Living with purpose changed everything for me, at least in the short term. During my senior year in high school, studying and working out gave my mind so much energy that hate flaked from my soul like used-up snakeskin. The resentment I held toward the racists in Brazil, the emotion that had dominated me and was burning me up inside, dissipated because I'd finally considered the fucking source. I looked at the people who were making me feel uncomfortable and realized how uncomfortable they were in their own skin. To make fun of or try to intimidate someone they didn't even know based on race alone was a clear indication that something was very wrong with them, not me. But when you have no confidence, it becomes easy to value other people's opinions, and I was valuing everyone's opinion without considering the minds that generated them. That sounds silly, but it's an easy trap to fall into, especially when you are insecure on top of being the only. As soon as I made that connection, being upset with them was not worth my time, because if I was going to kick their ass in life, and I was, I had way too much shit to do. Each insult or dismissive gesture became more fuel for the engine revving inside me. By the time I graduated, I knew that the confidence I'd managed to develop didn't come from a perfect family or God-given talent. It came from personal accountability, which brought me self-respect, and self-respect will always light a way forward. For me, it lit up a path straight out of Brazil, forever. But I didn't get away clean. When you transcend a place and time that has challenged you to the core, it can feel like you've won a war. Don't fall for that mirage. Your past, your deepest fears, have a way of going dormant before springing back to life at double strength. You must remain vigilant. For me, the Air Force revealed that I was still soft inside. I was still insecure. I wasn't yet hard of bone and mind. This is a good principle, the accountability mirror.
Yes, man, the accountability mirror is something that started it all for me. And it was so much easier to be someone else. That's why, you know, acting like I was cool, acting like a wannabe thug, sagging my pants, I was just living a dream world. Let's not be David Goggins. Let's just be this funny-looking character that's not dealing with his own problems. So it made my life so much easier to not deal with this fucked-up life that I had.
But I, at the same time, I could see how you'd do it. Like, you were kind of thriving. The comedy aspect of it does help you deal with it to some sense. It was almost like, it almost like was a painkiller, the comedy aspect of it, right?
Oh, yeah. It you know what's funny? It's the honest truth what you say. But the scary thing about it is you accomplish nothing.
Right.
Nothing gets accomplished. So, yeah, it helped me kind of get by.
Yeah.
But that's all I was doing was getting by. And I was afraid. I was really afraid to go back in that pile of shit. And by 18, 19 years old, I already had so much crap that I had to go through. I just kept putting it off.
Mm.
And the scary thing about it was I always knew that I had it in me. I always knew I had it in me to learn. I always knew I had it in me to be better. I knew that it was going to take me so many more hours than the normal person. I knew that I was coming into the game at such a deficit. And, you know, I didn't have these great parents. I didn't have this great foundation. So I had to almost by myself start rebuilding a house.
Mm.
And I knew what kind of work that was going to take for me to do this. So I just kept running away from the work.
What made you decide that it was the post-it notes? Because at first I could see you talking to yourself in the mirror and it becoming like its own trance.
Right.
But how did you decide to go to the post-it notes and start to actually make them kind of work detail?
So what was crazy about it is that my mind, the way it works, is if I don't have constant reminders, your mind is constantly looking for the path of least resistance. So if you're not constantly challenging yourself every day, for a person like me, if I'm not constantly looking at, okay, the task at hand today on my post-it notes on this mirror is to do this, my mind's going to say, hey, let's not do that today. let's go over here, go to Johnny's house, play basketball, and just fuck around. So I had to have a constant reminder of, hey, all right, David, we have to do X, Y, and Z today, or we can't do this and that. So I had to earn everything in my life from that point forward.
I remember Johnny, when we talked to Johnny, saying that it was almost like you just disappeared. Like he wanted to play basketball and you'd be at the kitchen table studying because you hadn't knocked it out yet.
You know what's funny about that, man? I didn't pick up a basketball. So this happened my junior year, and then my senior year, I played basketball. I didn't pick up a basketball for about 20 years.
Really?
Yep. And that's something I don't tell anybody. So basketball was my love. But I realized that basketball became my escape. And I no longer could escape from my life. So I started choosing whatever made me uncomfortable. I realized that I had to start gravitating towards that. And it was a long process. It wasn't like I woke up one morning, looked in the accountability mirror and figured out, oh, let me write some post-it notes down here and start doing this. We all have a voice in our head. We all have a voice in our head that is trying to direct you to a place where you can be better. We also have another voice in our head that's saying, ah, fuck that, let's not do that. So whatever that voice was saying that kind of sucked, that sucky voice that made me very uncomfortable, I started realizing that that's the only voice I can listen to. The other voice was a voice of comfort, and I had to stop listening to that voice because it always took me down the path of least resistance.
So this challenge that we set up is for your readers and listeners to set up their own accountability mirror.
Right.
And you've never really laid out that challenge to your followers before, have you?
No, this is something brand new. I've never even, well, I talk about the accountability mirror every now and then, but this is definitely brand new.
Where you're breaking out like how to's about it.
Exactly.
Challenge number two. It's time to come eyeball to eyeball with yourself and get raw and real. This is not a self-love tactic. You can't fluff it. Don't massage your ego. This is about abolishing the ego and taking the first step toward becoming the real you. I tack post-it notes on my accountability mirror, and I'll ask you to do the same. Digital devices won't work. Write all your insecurities, dreams, and goals on post-its and tag up your mirror. If you need more education, remind yourself that you need to start working your ass off because you aren't smart enough. Period. Point blank. If you look in the mirror and see someone who is obviously overweight, that means you're fucking fat. Own it. It's okay to be unkind with yourself in these moments because we need thicker skin to improve in life. Whether it's a career goal, quit my job, start a business, a lifestyle goal, lose weight and get more active, or an athletic one, run my first 5K, 10K, or marathon, you need to be truthful with yourself about where you are and the necessary steps it will take to achieve those goals day by day. Each step, each necessary point of self-improvement should be written as its own note. That means you have to do some research and break it all down. For example, if you're trying to lose 40 pounds, your first post-it may be to lose 2 pounds in the first week. Once that goal is achieved, remove the note and post the next goal of 2 to 5 pounds until your ultimate goal is realized. Whatever your goal, you'll need to hold yourself accountable for the small steps it will take to get there. Self-improvement takes dedication and self-discipline. The dirty mirror you see every day is going to reveal the truth. Stop ignoring it. Use it to your advantage. If you feel it, post an image of yourself staring into your tagged up accountability mirror on social media with the hashtags, hashtag can't hurt me, hashtag accountability mirror. Talk about the tone. And what it means to be, have thicker skin and why that's so important.
You know, we live in a world nowadays, especially now, we live in a soft generation, man. People are very soft, and people hate to admit that they're wrong. They hate to admit that they're wrong. Like, I mean, even for very simple things, it's much easier to blame somebody. People, that whole accountability thing, it sounds so simple, but how many times do you sit in a room when somebody messes up and no one really says, hey, I messed up. Hey, I apologize. I messed up. That's one of the hardest things to do. So that whole thick skin is to be able to take criticism, be able to criticize yourself. Why? We live in this society and we believe that everybody is so great and so perfect, but we haven't really realized that everybody's fucked up. Everybody's fucked up, even the people who are judging you. All that they're doing better than you is they're hiding. They're able to hide better than you are. So they make you feel like you're a piece of shit because they don't want to hold themselves accountable. So the whole thick skin thing is, whatever you are, own it. The only way you're going to lose weight is to say, hey, I'm overweight. I'm fat. You might be obese. The only way you're going to fix being smarter is say, you know what? I'm not the smartest cat in the world. I need to fix these things that I'm lacking in. And that's the only way I got better, was to develop thick skin. You know, back in the day, somebody would call me dumb. You know, yeah, it hurts your feelings, but are you dumb? Are you dumb? Yeah, it's hurtful. It hurts your feelings. Yeah, no one wants to hear it. But sometimes bullies are just telling you the fucking truth in a very mean way. And that's how you gotta look at it. You gotta look at, you know what, man? I'm not the smartest cat in the world. But use that strength. Use, like, you know, if you're getting bullied in a way, if they're calling you fat, don't go home and put your head down. Go home and say, you know what, I am fat. But I'm going to lose some fucking weight and go back to school or go back to whatever and say, hey, look at me now. Take a different vantage point in life. Don't look at it as always being hurt. Grow that thick skin. Grow daggone alligator skin to where nothing can hurt you. Not thick skin, grow alligator skin. And that's right there where you start getting the tactical advantage over everything, over yourself. Like I said before, your mind is always at the tactical advantage. It knows your fears. It knows your insecurities. You can't outrun them. So you might as well face them, hold yourself accountable, and then start to fix them.
Yeah, it's like in these days, everyone wants to sit in their feelings and have their feelings validated. Like, this is my emotional process. This is that. But what you're saying is, you know, there's a lot more to what you feel. You can't believe everything you feel.
Right.
Sometimes you have to go deeper and find your way out of the feeling.
Right, and even deeper than that is that a lot of people start to hang around people that, you know, allow them to have no accountability. You know, they have friends that say, oh yeah, it's their fault. They start to tell you everything you want to hear. And that's how you group your friends. You got that run friend that comes in and says, hey man, no, you're kind of fucked up. You need to change your way. You no longer want to hang with that person.
Yeah.
So, you know, we gotta look at, so this is all encompassing about everything you do in life. Pick the people around you that are gonna hold you to a higher standard, not a lower standard that makes you feel better.
I like it. I think that's one of the biggest problems in society is that people are afraid to hear what they don't wanna hear. And it makes us all worse off.
100%, man. And especially nowadays.
Yeah.
It's a much kinder, gentler world where everybody's winning. And at the end of the day, all you're doing is losing.
Chapter 3, The Impossible Task. It was past midnight and the streets were dead. I steered my pickup truck into another empty parking lot and killed the engine. In the quiet, all I could hear were the eerie halogen hum of the street lamps and the scratch of my pen as I checked off another franchise feed trough. The latest in a never-ending series of fast food and dine-in industrial kitchens that receive more nightly visitors than you'd care to know about. That's why guys like me showed up to places like this in the wee hours. I stuffed my clipboard under the armrest, grabbed my gear, and began restocking rat traps. They're everywhere, those little green boxes. Look around almost any restaurant and you'll find them, hidden in plain sight. My job was to bait, move, or replace them. Sometimes I hit pay dirt and found a rat carcass, which never caught me by surprise. You know death when you smell it. This wasn't the mission I signed up for when I enlisted in the Air Force with dreams of joining a pararescue unit. Back then I was 19 years old and weighed 175 pounds. By the time I was discharged 4 years later, I had ballooned to nearly 300 pounds and was on a different kind of patrol. At that weight, even bending down to bait the traps took effort. I was so damn fat I had to sew an athletic sock into the crotch of my work pants so they wouldn't split when I dropped to one knee. No bullshit. I was a sorry fucking sight. With the exterior handled, it was time to venture indoors, which was its own wilderness. I had keys to almost every restaurant in this part of Indianapolis, and their alarm codes too. Once inside, I pumped my handheld silver canister full of poison and placed a fumigation mask over my face. I looked like a damn space alien in that thing, with its dual filters jutting out from my mouth, protecting me from toxic fumes, protecting me. If there was anything I liked about that job, it was the stealth nature of working late, moving in and out of inky shadows. I loved that mask for the same reason. It was vital, and not because of any damn insecticide. I needed it because it made it impossible for anyone to see me, especially me. Even if by chance I caught my own reflection in a glass doorway or on a stainless steel countertop, it wasn't me I was seeing. It was some janky-ass, low-budget stormtrooper, the kind of guy who would palm yesterday's brownies on his way out the door. It wasn't me. Sometimes I'd see roaches scurry for cover when I flipped the lights on to spray down the counters and the tiled floors. I'd see dead rodents stuck to sticky traps I'd laid on previous visits. I bagged and dumped them. I checked the lighting systems I'd installed to catch moths and flies and clean those out too. Within a half hour, I was gone, rolling on to the next restaurant. I had a dozen stops every night and had to hit them all before dawn. Maybe this kind of gig sounds disgusting to you. When I think back, I'm disgusted too, but not because of the job. It was honest work, necessary. Hell, in Air Force boot camp, I got on the wrong side of my first drill sergeant and she made me the latrine queen. It was my job to keep the latrines in our barracks shining. She told me that if she found one speck of dirt in that latrine at any moment, I would get recycled back to day one and join a new flight. I took my discipline. I was happy just to be in the Air Force, and I cleaned the hell out of that latrine. You could have eaten off that floor. 4 years later, the guy who was so energized by opportunity that he was excited to clean latrines was gone, and I didn't feel anything at all. They say there's always light at the end of the tunnel, but not once your eyes adjust to the darkness, and that's what happened to me. I was numb. Numb to my life, miserable in my marriage, and I'd accepted that reality. I was a would-be warrior turned cockroach sniper on the graveyard shift. Just another zombie selling his time on Earth, going through the motions. In fact, the only insight I had into my job at that time was that it was actually a step up. When I first discharged from the military, I got a job at St. Vincent's Hospital. I worked security from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. for minimum wage and cleared about $700 a month. Every now and then, I'd see an Ecolab truck pull up. We were on the exterminator's regular rotation, and it was my job to unlock the hospital kitchen for him. One night, we got to talking, and he mentioned that Ecolab was hiring, and that the job came with a free truck and no boss looking over your shoulder. It was also a 35% pay raise. I didn't think about the health risks. I didn't think at all. I was taking what was being offered. I was on that spoon-fed path of least resistance, letting dominoes fall on my head, and it was killing me slowly. But there's a difference between being numb and clueless. In the dark night, there weren't a lot of distractions to get me out of my head, and I knew that I had tipped the first domino. I'd started the chain reaction that put me on Ecolab duty. The Air Force should have been my way out. That first drill sergeant did end up recycling me into a different unit, and in my new flight, I became a star recruit. I was 6'2" and weighed about 175 pounds. I was fast and strong. Our unit was the best flight in all of boot camp, and soon I was training for my dream job, Air Force Pararescue. We were guardian angels with fangs, trained to drop from the sky behind enemy lines and pull down pilots out of harm's way. I was one of the best guys in that training. I was one of the best at push-ups and the best at sit-ups, flutter kicks, and running. I was 1 point behind honor grad, but there was something they didn't talk about in the lead-up to pararescue training. Water confidence. That's a nice name for a course where they try to drown your ass for weeks, and I was uncomfortable as hell in the water. Although my mom got us off the public dole and out of subsidized housing within 3 years, she still didn't have extra cash for swim lessons, and we avoided pools. It wasn't until I attended Boy Scout camp when I was 12 years old that I was finally confronted with swimming. Leaving Buffalo allowed me to join the Scouts, and camp was my best opportunity to score all the merit badges I'd need to stay on the path to becoming an Eagle Scout. One morning, it was time to qualify for the swimming merit badge, and that meant a 1 mile swim in a lake course marked off with buoys. All the other kids jumped in and started getting after it, and if I wanted to save face, I had to pretend I knew what I was doing, so I followed them into the lake. I dog-paddled the best I could, but kept swallowing water, so I flipped onto my back and ended up swimming the entire mile with a fucked-up backstroke I'd improvised on the fly. Merit badge secured. When it came time to take the swim test to get into pararescue, I needed to be able to swim for real. This was a timed 500-meter freestyle swim, and even at 19 years old, I didn't know how to swim freestyle. So I took my stunted ass down to Barnes & Noble, bought Swimming for Dummies, studied the diagrams, and practiced in the pool every day. I hated putting my face in the water, but I'd managed for one stroke, then two, and before long, I could swim an entire lap. I wasn't as buoyant as most swimmers. Whenever I stopped swimming, even for a moment, I'd start to sink, which made my heart pound with panic, and my increased tension just made it worse. Eventually, I passed that swim test, but there is a difference between being competent and comfortable in the water. Another big gap from comfortable to confident, and when you can't float like most people, water confidence does not come easy. Sometimes, it doesn't come at all. In pararescue training, water confidence is part of the 10-week program, and it's filled with specific evolutions designed to test how well we perform in the water under stress. One of the worst evolutions for me was called bobbing. The class was divided into groups of five, lined up from gutter to gutter in the shallow end, and fully kitted up. Our backs were strapped with twin 80-liter tanks made from galvanized steel, and we wore 16-pound weight belts, too. We were loaded the fuck down, which would have been fine, except in this evolution, we weren't allowed to breathe from those tanks. Instead, we were told to walk backward, down the slope of the pool, from the 3-foot section to the deep end, about 10 feet down. And on that slow walk into position, my mind swirled with doubt and negativity. What the fuck are you doing here? This isn't for you. You can't swim. You're an imposter, and they will find you out. Time slowed down, and those seconds seemed like minutes. My diaphragm lurched, trying to force air into my lungs. Theoretically, I knew that relaxation was the key to all the underwater evolutions, but I was too terrified to let go. My jaw clenched as tight as my fists. My head throbbed as I worked to stave off panic. Finally, we were all in position, and it was time to start bobbing. That meant pushing up from the bottom to the surface without the benefit of finning, getting a gulp of air, and sinking back down. It wasn't easy getting up fully loaded, but at least I was able to breathe, and that first breath was a salvation. Oxygen flooded my system, and I started to relax until the instructor yelled, "Switch!" That was our cue to take our fins from our feet, place them on our hands, and use one pull with our arms to propel ourselves to the surface. We were allowed to push off the floor of the pool, but we couldn't kick. We did that for 5 minutes. Shallow water and surface blackouts aren't uncommon during water confidence training. It goes along with stressing the body and limiting oxygen intake. With the flippers on my hands, I'd barely get my face high enough out of the water to breathe, and in between, I was working hard and burning oxygen. And when you burn too much too fast, your brain shuts down, and you will black the fuck out. Our instructors called that meeting the wizard. As the clock ticked, I could see stars materializing in my peripheral vision and felt the wizard creeping close. I passed that evolution, and soon, finning with my arms or feet became easy for me. What stayed hard from beginning to end was one of our simplest tasks, treading water without our hands. We had to keep our hands and our chins high above the water, using only our legs, which we'd swirl in a blender-like motion, for 3 minutes. That doesn't sound like much time, and for most of the class, it was easy. For me, it was damn near impossible. My chin kept hitting the water, which meant the time would start again from 000. All around me, my classmates were so comfortable, their legs were barely moving, while mine were whirring at top speed, and I still couldn't get half as high as those white boys who looked to be defying gravity. Every day was another humiliation in the pool. Not that I was embarrassed publicly. I passed all the evolutions. But inside, I was suffering. Each night, I'd fixate on the next day's task and become so terrified I couldn't sleep. And soon, my fear morphed into resentment toward my classmates, who, in my mind, had it easy, which dredged up my past. I was the only black man in my unit, which reminded me of my childhood in rural Indiana, and the harder the water confidence training became, the higher those dark waters would rise, until it seemed I was also being drowned from the inside out. While the rest of my class was sleeping, that potent cocktail of fear and rage thrummed through my veins, and my nocturnal fixations became their own kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. One where failure was inevitable, because my unchecked fear was unleashing something I couldn't control, the quitting mind. It all came to a head 6 weeks into the training, with the buddy breathing exercise. We partnered up. Each pair gripped one another by the forearm and took turns breathing through just one snorkel. Meanwhile, the instructors thrashed us, trying to separate us from our snorkel. All of this was supposed to be happening at or near the surface, but I was negatively buoyant, which meant I was sinking into the middle waters of the deep end, dragging my partner down with me. He'd take a breath and pass the snorkel down to me. I'd swim to the surface, exhale, and attempt to clear the water from our snorkel and get a clean breath before passing it back to him. But the instructors made that almost impossible. I'd usually only clear the tube halfway and inhale more water than air. From the jump, I was operating from an oxygen deficit while fighting to stay near the surface. In military training, it's the instructor's job to identify weak links and challenge them to perform or quit, and they could tell I was struggling. In the pool that day, one of them was always in my face, yelling and thrashing me, while I choked, trying and failing to gulp air through a narrow tube to stave off the wizard. I went under and remember looking up at the rest of the class, splayed out like serene starfish on the surface, calm as can be. They passed their snorkels back and forth with ease, while I fumed. I know now that my instructor was just doing his job, but back then I thought, this fucker's not giving me a fair shot. I passed that evolution too, but I still had 11 more evolutions and 4 more weeks of water confidence training to go. It made sense. We would be jumping out of airplanes over water. We needed it. I just didn't want to do it anymore. And the next morning, I was offered a way out I hadn't seen coming. Weeks earlier, we'd had our blood drawn during a med check, and the doctors had just discovered I carried the sickle cell trait. I didn't have the disease, sickle cell anemia, but I had the trait, which was believed at the time to increase the risk of sudden exercise-related death due to cardiac arrest. The Air Force didn't want me dropping dead in the middle of an evolution and pulled me out of training on a medical. I pretended to take the news hard, as if my dream was being ripped away. I made a big fucking act of being pissed off, but inside, I was ecstatic. Later that week, the doctors reversed their decision. They didn't specifically say it was safe for me to continue, but they said the trait wasn't yet well understood and allowed me to decide for myself. When I reported back to training, the master sergeant informed me that I'd missed too much time and that if I wanted to continue, I would have to start over from day one, week one. Instead of less than 4 weeks, I'd have to endure another 10 weeks of the terror, rage, and insomnia that came with water confidence. These days, that kind of thing wouldn't even register on my radar. You tell me to run longer and harder than everyone else just to get a fair shake, I'd say, roger that, and keep moving. But back then, I was still half-baked. Physically, I was strong, but I was not even close to mastering my mind. The master sergeant stared at me, awaiting my response. I couldn't even look him in the eye when I said, "You know what, Master Sergeant? The doctor doesn't know much about this sickle cell thing, and it's bothering me." He nodded, emotionless, and signed the papers pulling me out of the program for good. He cited sickle cell, and on paper I didn't quit, but I knew the truth. If I had been the guy I am today, I wouldn't have given two fucks about sickle cell. I still have the sickle cell trait. You don't just get rid of it. But back then, an obstacle had appeared, and I'd folded. I moved on to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, told my friends and family that I was forced from the program on a medical, and served out my 4 years in the Tactical Air Control Party, TACP, which works with some special operations units. I trained or liaised between ground units and air support, fast movers like F-15s and F-16s, behind enemy lines. It was challenging work with intelligent people, but sadly I was never proud of it, and didn't see the opportunities offered because I knew I was a quitter who had let fear dictate my future. I buried my shame in the gym and at the kitchen table. I got into powerlifting and layered on the mass. I ate and worked out and ate. In my last days in the Air Force, I weighed 255 pounds. After my discharge, I continued to bulk up with both muscle and fat until I weighed nearly 300 pounds. I wanted to be big because being big hid David Goggins. I was able to tuck this 175-pound person into those 21-inch biceps and that flabby belly. I grew a burly mustache and was intimidating to everyone who saw me. But inside, I knew I was a pussy, and that's a haunting feeling. The morning I began to take charge of my destiny started out like any other. When the clock struck 7 a.m., my Ecolab shift ended, and I hit the Steak and Shake drive-thru to score a large chocolate milkshake. Next stop, 7-Eleven, for a box of Hostess mini chocolate donuts. I gobbled those on my 45-minute drive home to a beautiful apartment on a golf course in pretty Carmel, Indiana, which I shared with my wife, Pam, and her daughter. Remember that Pizza Hut incident? I married that girl. I married a girl whose dad called me a nigger. What does that say about me? We couldn't afford that life. Pam wasn't even working, but in those credit card debt-loading days, nothing made much sense. I was doing 70 miles per hour on the highway, mainlining sugar and listening to a local classic rock station when Sound of Silence poured from the stereo. Simon and Garfunkel's words echoed like truth. Darkness was a friend indeed. I worked in the dark, hid my true self from friends and strangers. Nobody would have believed how numb and afraid I was back then because I looked like a beast that no one would dare fuck with. But my mind wasn't right, and my soul was weighed down by too much trauma and failure. I had every excuse in the world to be a loser, and used them all. My life was crumbling, and Pam dealt with that by fleeing the scene. Her parents still lived in Brazil, just 70 miles away. We spent most of our time apart. I arrived home from work around 8 a.m., and the phone rang as soon as I walked in the door. It was my mother. She knew my routine. "Come on over for your staple," she said. My staple was a breakfast buffet for one, the likes of which few could put down in a single sitting. Think 8 Pillsbury cinnamon rolls, a half dozen scrambled eggs, a half pound of bacon, and 2 bowls of Fruity Pebbles. Don't forget, I had just decimated a box of donuts and a chocolate shake. I didn't even have to respond. She knew I was coming. Food was my drug of choice, and I always sucked up every last crumb. I hung up, flipped on the television, and stomped down the hall to the shower, where I could hear a narrator's voice filter through the steam. I caught snippets. Navy SEALs. Toughest. The world. I wrapped a towel around my waist and rushed back into the living room. I was so big, the towel barely covered my fat ass, but I sat down on the couch and didn't move for 30 minutes. The show followed basic underwater demolition SEAL, BUDS, training class 224, through Hell Week, the most arduous series of tasks in the most physically demanding training in the military. I watched men sweat and suffer as they tore through muddy obstacle courses, ran on the soft sand holding logs overhead, and shivered in icy surf. Sweat pearled on my scalp. I was literally on the edge of my seat as I saw guys, some of the strongest of them all, ring the bell and quit. Made sense. Only 1/3 of the men who begin BUDS make it through Hell Week. And in all of my time in pararescue training, I couldn't remember feeling as awful as these men looked. They were swollen, chafed, sleep-deprived, and dead on their feet, and I was jealous of them. The longer I watched, the more certain I became that there were answers buried in all that suffering. Answers that I needed. More than once, the camera panned over the endless, frothing ocean, and each time I felt pathetic. The SEALs were everything I wasn't. They were about pride, dignity, and the type of excellence that came from bathing in the fire, getting beat the fuck down, and going back for more, again and again. They were the human equivalent of the hardest, sharpest sword you could imagine. They sought out the flame, took the pounding for as long as necessary, longer even, until they were fearless and deadly. They weren't motivated. They were driven. The show ended with graduation. 22 proud men stood shoulder to shoulder in their dress whites before the camera pushed in on their commanding officer. "In a society where mediocrity is too often the standard and too often rewarded," he said, "there is intense fascination with men who detest mediocrity, who refuse to define themselves in conventional terms, and who seek to transcend traditionally recognized human capabilities. This is exactly the type of person BUDS is meant to find. The man who finds a way to complete each and every task to the best of his ability. The man who will adapt and overcome any and all obstacles." In that moment, it felt as though the commanding officer was talking directly to me. But after the show ended, I walked back to the bathroom, faced the mirror, and stared myself down. I looked every bit of 300 pounds. I was everything all the haters back home said I would be. Uneducated, with no real-world skills, zero discipline, and a dead-end future. Mediocrity would have been a major promotion. I was at the bottom of the barrel of life, pooling in the dregs. But for the first time in way too long, I was awake. I barely spoke to my mother during breakfast and only ate half my staple because my mind was on unfinished business. I'd always wanted to join an elite special operations unit, and beneath all the rolls of flesh and layers of failure, that desire was still there. Now it was coming back to life, thanks to a chance viewing of a show that continued to work on me like a virus moving cell to cell, taking over. It became an obsession I couldn't shake. Every morning after work for almost 3 weeks, I called active duty recruiters in the Navy and told them my story. I called offices all over the country. I said I was willing to move as long as they could get me to SEAL training. Everyone turned me down. Most weren't interested in candidates with prior service. One local recruiting office was intrigued and wanted to meet in person, but when I got there, they laughed in my face. I was way too heavy, and in their eyes, I was just another delusional pretender. I left that meeting feeling the same way. After calling all the active duty recruiting offices I could find, I dialed the local unit of the Naval Reserves and spoke to Petty Officer Steven Shaljo for the first time. Shaljo had worked with multiple F-14 squadrons as an electrician and instructor at NAS Miramar for 8 years before joining the recruitment staff in San Diego, where the SEALs train. He worked day and night and rose quickly in the ranks. His move to Indianapolis came with a promotion and the challenge of finding Navy recruits in the middle of the corn. He'd only been on the job in Indy for 10 days by the time I called, and if I'd reached anyone else, you probably wouldn't be listening to this book. But through a combination of dumb luck and stubborn persistence, I found one of the finest recruiters in the Navy, a guy whose favorite task was discovering diamonds in the rough. Prior service guys like me who are looking to re-enlist and hoping to land in special operations. Our initial conversation didn't last long. He said he could help me and that I should come in to meet in person. That sounded familiar. I grabbed my keys and drove straight to his office, but didn't get my hopes too high. By the time I arrived a half hour later, he was already on the phone with Bud's administration. Every sailor in that office, all of them white, were surprised to see me, except Shaljo. If I was a heavyweight, Shaljo was a lightweight at 5'7", but he didn't seem fazed by my size, at least not at first. He was outgoing and warm, like any salesman, though I could tell he had some pit bull in him. He led me down a hall to weigh me in, and while standing on the scale, I eyed a weight chart pinned to the wall. At my height, the maximum allowable weight for the Navy was 191 pounds. I held my breath, sucked in my gut as much as I could, and puffed out my chest in a sorry attempt to stave off the humiliating moment where he'd let me down easy. That moment never came. "You're a big boy," Shaljo said, smiling and shaking his head as he scratched 297 pounds on a chart in his file folder. The Navy has a program that allows recruits in the reserves to become active duty. That's what we'll use for this. It's being phased out at the end of the year, so we need to get you classed up before then. Point is, you have some work to do, but you knew that. I followed his eyes to the weight chart and checked it again. He nodded, smiled, patted me on the shoulder, and left me to face my truth. I had less than 3 months to lose 106 pounds. It sounded like an impossible task, which is one reason I didn't quit my job. The other was the ASVAB. That nightmare test had come back to life like Frankenstein's fucking monster. I'd passed it once before to enlist in the Air Force, but to qualify for BUDS, I'd have to score much higher. For 2 weeks, I studied all day and zapped pests each night. I wasn't working out yet. Serious weight loss would have to wait. I took the test on a Saturday afternoon. The following Monday, I called Shaljo. "Welcome to the Navy," he said. He downloaded the good news first. I'd done exceptionally well on some sections. I was now officially a reservist, but I'd only scored a 44 on mechanical comprehension. To qualify for BUDS, I needed a 50. I'd have to retake the entire test in 5 weeks. These days, Steven Shaljo likes to call our chance connection fate. He said he could sense my drive the first moment we spoke, and that he believed in me from the jump, which is why my weight wasn't an issue for him. But after that ASVAB test, I was full of doubt. So maybe what happened later that night was also a form of fate, or a much-needed dose of divine intervention. I'm not going to drop the name of the restaurant where it went down, because if I did, you'd never eat there again, and I'd have to hire a lawyer. Just know, this place was a disaster. I checked the traps outside first and found a dead rat. Inside, there were more dead rodents, a mouse and two rats, on the sticky traps, and roaches in the garbage which hadn't been emptied. I shook my head, got down on my knees under the sink, and sprayed up through a narrow gap in the wall. I didn't know it yet, but I'd found their nesting column, and when the poison hit, they started to scatter. Within seconds, there was a skittering across the back of my neck. I brushed it off and craned my neck to see a storm of roaches raining down to the kitchen floor from an open panel in the ceiling. I'd hit the mother load of cockroaches, and the worst infestation I ever saw on the job for Ecolab. They kept coming. Roaches landed on my shoulders and my head. The floor was writhing with them. I left my canister in the kitchen, grabbed the sticky traps, and burst outside. I needed fresh air and more time to figure out how I was going to clear the restaurant of vermin. I considered my options on my way to the dumpster to trash the rodents, opened the lid, and found a live raccoon, hissing mad. He bared his yellow teeth and lunged at me. I slammed the dumpster shut. What the fuck? I mean, seriously, what the fucking fuck? When was enough truly going to be enough? Was I willing to let my sorry present become a fucked up future? How much longer would I wait? How many more years would I burn, wondering if there was some greater purpose out there waiting for me? I knew right then that if I didn't make a stand and start walking the path of most resistance, I would end up in this mental hell forever. I didn't go back inside that restaurant. I didn't collect my gear. I started my truck, stopped for a chocolate shake, my comfort tea at that time, and drove home. It was still dark when I pulled up. I didn't care. I stripped off my work clothes, put on some sweats, and laced up my running shoes. I hadn't run in over a year, but I hit the streets ready to go 4 miles. I lasted 400 yards. My heart raced. I was so dizzy I had to sit down on the edge of the golf course to catch my breath before making the slow walk back to my house, where my melted shake was waiting to comfort me in yet another failure. I grabbed it, slurped, and slumped into my sofa. My eyes welled with tears. Who the fuck did I think I was? I was born nothing, I'd proven nothing, and I still wasn't worth a damn thing. David Goggins, a Navy SEAL? Yeah, right. What a pipe dream. I couldn't even run down the block for 5 minutes. All my fears and insecurities I'd bottled up for my entire life started raining down on my head. I was on the verge of giving in and giving up for good. That's when I found my old beat-to-shit VHS copy of Rocky, the one I'd had for 15 years. Slid it into the machine and fast-forwarded to my favorite scene, round 14. The original Rocky is still one of my all-time favorite films because it's about a know-nothing journeyman fighter living in poverty with no prospects. Even his own trainer won't work with him. Then, out of the blue, he's given a title shot with a champion, Apollo Creed, the most feared fighter in history. A man that has knocked out every opponent he's ever faced. All Rocky wants is to be the first to go the distance with Creed. That alone will make him someone he could be proud of for the first time in his life. The fight is closer than anyone anticipated, bloody and intense, and by the middle rounds, Rocky is taking on more and more punishment. He's losing the fight, and in round 14, he gets knocked down early, but pops right back up in the center of the ring. Apollo moves in, stalking him like a lion. He throws sharp left jabs, hits a slow-footed Rocky with a staggering combination, lands a punishing right hook, and another. He backs Rocky into a corner. Rocky's legs are jelly. He can't even muster the strength to raise his arms in defense. Apollo slams another right hook into the side of Rocky's head, then a left hook, and a vicious right-handed uppercut that puts Rocky down. Apollo retreats to the opposite corner with his arms held high. But even face down in that ring, Rocky doesn't give up. As the referee begins his 10 count, Rocky squirms toward the ropes. Mickey, his own trainer, urges him to stay down, but Rocky isn't hearing it. He pulls himself up to one knee, then all fours. The referee hits 6 as Rocky grabs the ropes and rises up. The crowd roars, and Apollo turns to see him still standing. Rocky waves Apollo over. The champ's shoulders slump in disbelief. The fight isn't over yet. I turned off the television and thought about my own life. It was a life devoid of any drive and passion. But I knew if I continued to surrender to my fear and my feelings of inadequacy, I would be allowing them to dictate my future forever. My only other choice was to try to find the power in the emotions that had laid me low, harness and use them to